And then there's a lot of those sort of preteen ages that are getting left behind, and they don't get the stuff that engages with their emotions and with the complexity of their minds at that age sufficiently. So horror really is a great arena to do that, because you can touch on things that are complicated and that are emotionally dense.
That's Jack McKay, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Jack McKay is a writer and theater maker known for blending emotional storytelling with unsettling horror. His debut novel, Gloam, earned critical attention, and now he returns with The Haunting of Old Splinter. Jack, welcome to Conversations.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dan.
Well, this is a retelling of that classic monkey's paw type of tale. Tell us about why you wanted to re-envision this for this middle grade novel.
It's funny, because I actually read The Monkey's Paw when I was about 12 or 13. It was given to us as a sort of reading material in our English class at school. And I don't think it's the kind of book that you would necessarily read to children, and you wouldn't necessarily think is for kids. But we were given it at that age. And it's only about sort of maybe 10 to 12 pages long. But the amount of atmosphere and character and real sort of building fear that is built into that story, the sense of like escalating dread as you realize what is happening. I won't spoil it if there's anybody who hasn't read it yet, because I think that the effect of that story is so potent when you read it for the first time, not knowing what happens. But there is an incredible scene involving a knocking on the door, which stuck with me for a long time as a kid, right the way through to an adult. And it was only when I was talking to my agent about future ideas, and we had lots of things running around. We actually had another book that I had written, and we were working together on editing it. And my agent just said to me, "Oh, you know, I really feel like, you know, I love The Monkey's Paw, and The Monkey's Paw is so great. You know, have you read it?" And I thought, "Yes, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about that story in ages." And she said, "You know what? If you were looking for something to retell, that's a great story, because it freaked me out when I was a kid." And I thought, "Well, I had the same experience." So I went back and I reread it, and all my, you know, my mind started spinning, and I thought, this is just such a, like I said, so much crammed into this one, you know, short story. So I came up with a draft for a novel that would be a sort of middle grade retelling of that, with some extra sort of, you know, themes and tropes that I was particularly interested in at the time. And then it all spiraled from there. And my publishers ended up saying, "We like this so much, could we do this for book two?" So I wrote it very, very quickly. But I think it's been a really rewarding process to sort of revisit that story and channel all of that energy into something new.
So tell us about your re-envisioning, your reimagining of this story. What's the plot of The Haunting of Old Splinter?
Well, it is a story about a boy, primarily a boy called Peter, and he is raised in a blended family situation. So when he was very, very young, his mother divorced his father and married another man called George, who is from Hong Kong. And Peter's younger brother, who's only a couple years younger than him, is from that second marriage. So they have this sort of, it's a little bit of an unusual blend, a sort of British-English, Hong Kong blended family. And Peter's dad, biological father, is only, you know, lives just in the neighboring city. So it's still part of his life. And it's quite a complicated family situation. Complicated further by the fact that they are there renovating. They live in this town called Bargest on the Moor, on the Yorkshire Moors, in the north of England. And it's this very desolate sort of spooky place. But the town itself is this little pocket of niceness. And there's a mansion there called Old Splinter by the locals, which George is renovating on behalf of his very wealthy older brother who owns the estate. And while they are there, these rumors start to circle about a magician who used to own the house. And that magician sort of stumbled across this thing called the Wishing Claw. And it is supposedly this pickled hand that he found on these travels abroad that apparently has the power to grant wishes. And the magician vanished one day, taking the claw with him. The more Peter starts to investigate these rumors, the more he realizes that there might be more to them than he thinks. And when the family starts to run into sort of quite normal domestic troubles and the bonds between them start to fray, Peter thinks, "Well, I'm going to use this magic to fix our problems, whether it be money problems or whether it be family problems or all of those things, you know, loop together." So it's very much a be careful what you wish for narrative, but I was particularly that's been done a lot of times before. And I was particularly interested in sort of grounding it very strongly in quite a realistic, quite knotty, quite thorny family situation. A loving family situation, but a complicated one that I think a lot of people like myself might have lived in, but, you know, maybe haven't seen it represented in traditional fiction before. I should say, while there's lots drawn, I come from a blended family, British Hong Kong blended family, but I've never had as much angst as Peter has in the book. I was just sort of imagining, what if my lovely family situation had a couple extra sort of curveballs thrown in to make things, you know, more emotionally challenging. And that's the sort of the crux of the story.
So this relationship between Peter and his slightly younger brother is integral to this plot. So tell us more about the brothers and how you were able to bring perhaps your background experience into creating this family unit.
Yeah, it's such an unconventional family, but the thing that I felt that was very, not only very important, but something that I think is quite lovely about the dynamic in the story is that Peter and Adrian are from technically separate fathers, but it's established from, you know, the first couple pages that they don't perceive the word half as being part of their brotherly relationship. They don't consider themselves to be half brothers. They are totally fine calling each other brothers. And that's very much been part of my life. I mean, while I say that not much of this is literally based on my upbringing, the part that is the sense that I've been raised by a stepdad who I don't call my stepdad. I just call it my dad. I've been raised alongside two siblings who come from my mum and dad's, you know, relationship and marriage, but we don't consider each other half siblings. We just can call each other siblings. And I think that even though when we're out and about in public, we might look different to each other. Yeah, I do. You do get some weird looks as like the oldest kid who's a very, very visibly English, white English, and next to these kids who are both very visibly Asian. You sort of have this like weird, they're like, oh, maybe the genes just sort of skipped him a bit. there is this sort of definitely this strange place that you occupy in the world when you are a blended family like that. But I always liked the fact that they were able to exist quite naturally together. And all of the sort of difficulty that comes into their lives, the complexity that they have, where Adrian, the youngest brother, is very happy in his family situation, but Peter sort of feels a little bit like he's on the outside because his dad is his biological father is still sort of orbiting in the background, and he sort of feels like he can't really talk to his stepdad George in the same way that his younger brother can. He feels like there's too much that's asked of him to be both a brother, but also to look after his younger brother, but also to sort of manage all of this adult stuff that's happening above him that he can't fully comprehend. I think that there's a lot that's sort of sitting on him that his younger brother Adrian is insulated from, and that if there's any tension between them, it is caused by that primarily, this sense of a great responsibility that rests upon the older brother, and also the slight sense of feeling a little bit separated by them. I never felt this as a young kid. You know, my situation always felt eminently normal to me growing up. And I think that's a testament to, you know, the work that my parents and grandparents sort of put in to make my life feel very natural and normal. But for Peter, things are a little bit different. His biological father is a little bit more, I think, has some specific ideas about what his responsibilities are and the relationship that he wants to have with Peter, and his maybe not necessarily entirely amenable feelings towards Peter's new family. And by the same token, my dad's siblings are lovely. But in this book, Uncle Lawrence, who is the brother of the stepdad, who is this very rich, very flighty character who's constantly back and forth from England to Hong Kong, he sort of swoop into their lives and pour all this money and love and presence onto Adrian and sort of leave Peter out a little bit. And there is almost this sense of otherness that starts to develop within Peter's soul as a result of that. So it's a bit of a complicated situation for them. But I love that brotherly relationship in particular as a sort of, it is the anchor that I think holds Peter together. And it's definitely something that he comes to rely on when things get a little bit supernatural and scary and Peter's feeling very alone. That brotherly relationship is the thing that he's able to hold on to and sort of find strength in. And I relate to that a lot as an older brother who loves my siblings very much. That is something that was, you know, very important to me.
So Peter goes through this arc throughout the book, and his heart is in the right place. You know, he sees his family being stressed. He hears about this thing, this claw that can, grant his wishes. So he starts out there, his heart's in the right place, but things go terribly wrong.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I did want to, I think in particular, that's kind of the draw of Be Careful What You Wish For stories. We tell them a lot and have done for a long time. And often it's rarely things, I think we are quite allured by and horrified by the idea that bad things can come out of good intentions. Peter is driven by this sense to repair the bonds in his family, but also to try and do something good for his stepdad, who's really stressed by this enormous renovation project that's going terribly wrong. And the haunting of Old Splinter in the title is less so of a literal haunting and more so of a sense of a nameless curse that seems to be following them everywhere they go, that they attribute to this house. I mean, things keep going wrong. They're over budget. George sort of injures himself while he's working on the building. They find dark, weird stuff inside the house that causes knock-on effects. I mean, there is all of this happening. And as a kid, when there's lots of adult stuff happening around you that you feel a bit helpless as a result of sort of being in the middle of this turmoil, it's a very natural feeling to want to fix that when you're 12. And so Peter feels the urge to do that by embracing sort of supernatural things. And I think that the horror of it comes from the sense that if we were in Peter's situation, we would probably do something similar to what he does. You just don't know what the consequences of meddling with great power is going to be. And I was particularly drawn to the idea of not just doing, I didn't want a wishing object that sort of twisted the wishes arbitrarily. I wanted it to feel like the consequences could have been foreseen and were proportional to the scale of the wish. If you want to change the world, that's a wonderful thing, but how are you changing the world and how are you using that great power? And if you're using it for certain ends that would require a huge bend in reality to accommodate you, what are the knock-on effects, the ripples of that going to be? That's I think what Peter ends up exploring sometimes to his benefit and sometimes very much not.
I want to talk a little bit about Old Splinter itself, because it's so atmospheric. It's like a character unto itself. Was there a particular building or story that kind of inspired your vision of Old Splinter?
Ah, that's a great question, because Gloam, my first book, was very much based on a real setting. It was based on my grandparents' house. This one there isn't necessarily a direct real world analog to the house, to Old Splinter itself, but you are right. It does sort of have this kind of personality almost. And I think it is described as sort of having a face, almost like it's looking at them all the time. I mean, I love the film Monster House, which is a great film for kids that came out when I was very, very young. And that was something that where there is a literal personality inside a house. So I suppose I was imagining that a lot. But also, the great Shirley Jackson wrote a story called The Haunting of Hill House. The Haunting of Old Splinter, I should say, was not our first choice of title. But when it did land as The Haunting of Old Splinter, I felt it did feel right, because it was part of this lineage from a story that it did inspire me. And in The Haunting of Hill House, arguably one of the best ghost stories ever told, there is this sense of the house itself is alive. And the house itself has a sort of an influence over its inhabitants and the people who come near it. So that was something that really did inspire me. Whether or not that literally happens in A Haunting of Old Splinter, whether or not it's literally alive, is another story. But the idea of bodies walled up inside it that and the ghosts that inhabit it and sort of, you know, creep in and start to curse the people who live there, it does start to get to them. And I feel like a lot of people, even people who are very disconnected from the supernatural, if you live in intense, difficult emotional circumstances, and you are surrounded by this, a building like Old Splinter, which is so characterful and old and decrepit and creaky, I do think that there would, even the most rational person would, I think, be affected by those circumstances and maybe start to think, ooh, is this place feels alive. This place feels like it has an intention for me. So yeah, that's where that came from.
I want to ask you a little bit about horror stories themselves as a genre, because I imagine there might be some parents that say, I don't know if my kid's ready to read this sort of thing, but what would you tell them about really the benefits of horror stories for a young person?
Well, first of all, thank you for the question, because this is something I love to talk about, and I do talk about frequently to young members of my own family. I can imagine people listening to me talking about quite scary, spooky, intense stuff and thinking, oh gosh, I don't know whether I want to go near it. But I should say that I talk about horror for young people in the same way that I talk about horror for adults, because in my opinion, I think that sometimes we do over-categorize things into being for kids and being for grown-ups. And sometimes I think that is to the detriment of children specifically, because what we end up doing is we end up sort of splitting things that are emotionally complex off and fencing them off into places and calling them adult in a way that kids are prevented from accessing, which I think does a great disservice to the minds of young people. Kids are very curious. Kids are very interested in darkness and gruesomeness. But more than that, I think that they are yearning, especially now at a time where, I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen the stats for how things are in the States at the moment, but in the UK, we're experiencing this really, what's being described as a sort of reading for pleasure crisis amongst young kids, especially in the middle grade range, where they are in primary school, kids tend to be reading a lot, and then they go up into secondary school, which I suppose is sort of a fusion of middle and high school, and they drop off big time around about sort of 11, 12, and then in their teen years, really, really struggle to read. And I think that part of it is because that is the age group that is kind of being left behind in traditional fiction. There's a lot of stuff that's made for kids. There's a lot of stuff that's made for 15-year-olds and older. And then there's a lot of those sort of preteen ages that are getting left behind, and they don't get the stuff that engages with their emotions and with the complexity of their minds at that age sufficiently. So horror really is a great arena to do that, because you can touch on things that are complicated and that are emotionally dense in ways that can still be very fun in a sort of genre rompy way, but also in a way that is if you have a kid who's reading a book and feels, oh my gosh, this is really scary, I love it, this is the kind of stuff you want to read under the covers with a torch. It has such an impact on us when we're scared of things. And I, like a lot of kids my age who watched scary things or read scary things when we were kids, you sort of fixate on them. You sort of think about them very deeply because they have that strong emotional impact on us. And so I wanted to write that sort of thing for the next generation of young kids like my siblings and people their age.
So through horror, like in your story, there's grief, there's accepting things we can't change, there's guilt, there's all sorts of things in the story that maybe a kid wouldn't think about or be exposed to in other types of stories, but they get exposed to it here and, you know, maybe not even realize it because it's just part of the story, but it gets them thinking about it.
Definitely. And that's such a key element of it too, which is, I think, the idea that stories are a window into other people's experiences. And you experience those themes and those messages and those ideas, not as me, the author, sitting down and writing it in a sort of didactic, you know, this is what you should think about the world, and more so giving kids the tools themselves to be able to take them and think, okay, how do I apply what I understand about life to this story? How do I apply what this story is teaching me or saying to me to the real world around me? And I think making judgments based on their own experiences and their own values. And I think that reading and engaging with fiction, even fiction that might seem quite gaudy and scary and gruesome, can really be a great way to sort of develop our emotional sense and our inner lives, especially when we're young. So I much prefer fiction that sort of engages with that stuff almost as a matter of fact, sort of as part of the story, rather than this is not a manifesto. This is just a story that people will have fun with, but it's also something that maybe by engaging with it seriously, sometimes you might discover things about yourself along the way. Who knows?
Yeah, we've been talking about this as a middle grade book, but for those who aren't familiar with that term, for what age would you recommend the book?
Well, middle grade, I think, is one of those categories that's a little bit floaty, but in general, it tends to circle around 9 to 12. That's the age where it's definitely pitched in the UK. I think 9 to 12 is kind of perfect, but just like with the book one, I really approached it as being the kind of story that hopefully would open itself up to anybody who was ready for it, and that includes older kids. You might have some very intrepid, 7 or 8 year olds who are reading well above their usual reading level and are, you know, really hardy and they're ready for some scary stuff. But 9 to 12 is a good starting point. But when we were having discussions about the book cover and having discussions about the content of the story and the vocabulary of the story. We wanted it to be the kind of thing that would still be accessible and readable and enjoyable to kids who were older than 12 and older than the traditional middle grade category. I read books like Coraline as an adult and wrote my university dissertation on it. And I still read fairy tales and I still read, you know, horror stories written for kids or even just, you know, things like Earthsea I've just finished recently that was written for young kids originally. So being one of those stories that has that sort of range, that was my dream, something that adults could maybe enjoy or that a 14-year-old wouldn't feel embarrassed to read on the bus. You know, I feel like writing stuff that has that kind of appeal, it's an audience that includes children but isn't limited to children. That was my intention.
Jack, what's next for you?
Well, what is next? I'm writing at the moment another book that is a little bit different, sort of more along the dark fantasy sort of fairy tale roots of a lot of horror fiction. I mean, there are still ghosts and scary things involved, but it's sort of very interested in the dark forest you find in fairy tales and old literature and the way that forests relate to dreams and memory. I mean, so I'm writing something that sort of tries to synthesize a lot of those ideas into a legible story for young people. It's proving a bit challenging. And it's one of the weirder things that I've written, but I'm hoping that it's interesting. And in the meantime, I'm talking to lots of people about this one and talking a lot about wishes and what makes them fun and exciting to read about.
This middle grade novel is The Haunting of Old Splinter by Jack Mackay. Jack, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Dan. And it was lovely talking to you for Glam and really lovely talking to you this one as well.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.